Now at 11 minutes past two, 1 o'clock here, I'm delighted to welcome to the programme Tony Gosling, who is UK-based broadcaster and journalist. Good afternoon, Tony.
Hi, Pippa.
Lovely. And thank you so much for joining me today. Let's start. I've asked you to come on to help us read between the lines of the news that is fed to us by the mainstream media. I've got two web pages of news providers here open in front of me. I've got the BBC, East Ukraine militants snub Geneva deal on crisis. I've got RT, that headline reads, military operation in Ukraine southeast to go on despite Geneva agreement.
Yes, fascinating, isn't it? We can see now, just how the media works. I mean, actually, we used to get in this country, and in fact, most of the Western world, we used to get a reasonable amount of balance. I mean, even when it came to things like, I can remember back in the 1970s, the Vietnam War, things like that, there would be a bit about both sides. It was obvious whose side we were supposed to be on. But nowadays, I think many of these wars are actually being fought in our newsrooms. I mean, if I go into a BBC newsroom, for example, which I do from time to time, you can see there's actually a little war going on in there between those members, often the union members, who are doing their best to tell the truth, hanging on to their jobs for dear life, some of them, and those who are, shall we say, company men or company women, people who are just doing the bidding of the boss, and then they know that if they do that, they stand a better chance of promotion. And often, you know, good people are passed over for promotion. Sometimes, naive youngsters are brought in straight out of college, straight out of a journalism course or even just a sort of media studies course to take over from seasoned hacks. So, you know, the owners and the controllers of these outlets are very rarely thought about and have very little public profile. But of course, the journalists don't own the transmitters. The journalists don't own the printing presses. And it's the owners that we should really be pointing the finger at. I mean, in Ukraine particularly, the use of language, the way that we have militants or protesters, and the use of language there has been really stark. You know, when there were gunmen storming the parliament in Kiev, there was very little talk. I mean, even though it only happened over a few hours, there was very little talk about that. The government had been overturned. We got a new government, but it wasn't really described in the same way as the current situation in eastern Ukraine has been deciding. And poor old Ukraine, like many other independent countries around the world, are finding that they're going to have to choose sides between Russia and the Russian Federation and the Western world. Probably the most worrying thing about the whole situation in Ukraine, I'm sure this is something which concerns many Ukrainians too, is the rise of the far right. We're not talking about neo-Nazis here. We're talking about Nazis. We're talking about people who have pictures of SS generals who were Ukrainians, many of them. There were, quite a large number of Ukrainian SS personnel up on their walls, on their websites, this sort of thing. This is history could possibly be repeating itself, because actually Ukraine, the fighting that went on in Second World War in Ukraine was probably the worst of the Second World War. In that whole way down the Eastern Front there, there was absolute carnage and misery most of the time. And it was a battle fought backwards and forwards, a real vicious battle with very little, very few prisoners taken. Something like 3 million Russian prisoners of war were murdered by the Nazis. So, you can see that this, on the Eastern Front, this runs very deep, this wound in Ukraine. And I'm not at all surprised that a little coup in Kiev is being, to a certain extent, it's not just being ignored, it's being challenged by many of the people who are generally ethnically Russian-speaking. I think the thing that really sparked this in the first place was the idiotic decision by the new Kiev junta to outlawed the Russian language. Now, that was a decision which was then reversed because, some of the controllers from the Western side and the EU supporters said, look, you just can't do this. This is a disaster. But that's really what's been going on.
It's a blatant statement, isn't it? I mean, there's absolutely no way that can be interpreted any other way than aggressively.
Yeah, so Ukrainians, most would love to stay independent, but what they're finding is, in order to finance the country, they've got to go to either one side or the other side. They haven't got the financial resources, the international economic clout to run their own debt, to service their own debt, so they have to go to one of the money lenders or the other. And even though democratically, it looks as if they chose through their president to go with the Russian side. You know, the things have been changed in Kiev. And in a way, it shows what's happening in Ukraine, shows that some of what's been going on in the Middle East is a bit of a sideshow. You know, the Syrian, the horrors of Syria. Now, what you've got is you've got Russian influence there, and you've got NATO influence there. In many of the Gulf states, you've got Russian influence and NATO influence. So, in a way, what we're doing is we're coming down to brass tacks. You know, you've got people in Ukraine who are desperately trying to get away from this problem, as we would be if something like similar was happening. I mean, we had our civil war 350 years ago here, and hopefully not another one. But you know, what you've got is you've got the outside powers massing. You've got NATO massing, starting to anyway bring forces in from the US onto the western borders of Ukraine, and you've got the Russians on the eastern borders. And what they're doing, of course, is they're not standing idly by. They are using special forces, undercover tactics, black operations within Ukraine to try and fight for various bits of territory. And mm-hmm. I mean, I just hope to goodness that they will see sense and that there will be quick elections. What we need, of course, is referendums, I think, in separate parts of the Ukraine, because there is a big difference between a lot of the people in the non-Russian-speaking, Ukrainian-speaking people in the west of the country and in the east, the Russian-speaking parts. And so the best thing, as far as I can see, would be for each of the different provinces of Ukraine to decide, you know, which way do they want to be on. Otherwise, you know, trying to keep the entire country together seems to be, you know, like that's probably not going to work.
Certainly, I think you're absolutely right. If you, you know, follow this close enough and listen to, read interviews and listen to snippets of people on the street who've been interviewed, there are, of course, people who want to stay, who want to throw in their lot with Russia. There are people who are Ukrainian who want to stay Ukrainian, but they're not happy with what's happening in Kiev. I mean, there are every sort of, every which way you look, there are different makeups of people who have different feelings, and the only way for those people is to have referendums. However, Tony, you know, this by the nature, the geopolitical nature of where this piece of land is, just like the geopolitical nature perhaps of where Syria is, essentially, you know, this is just another, this is becoming another stage on which a battle between superpowers is going to be played out, regardless of what those people want.
Yeah, and the interface between them, that and us, is the international media, which you were talking about. You know, what you've got is, and I think, and I'll, if you don't mind, I'll just mention the Malaysian airliner story for a moment, because it really clear to me, looking at that story, I mean, as a journalist, you're looking at the way that certain aspects of the story have elbowed out other aspects of the story. You know, for example, when Rolls-Royce first announced that the airliner had flown on for 5 hours, there was an avalanche of denials by people who couldn't possibly know whether or not the Rolls-Royce had got their facts right. That, to me, absolutely, I mean, and I would urge your listeners always to look out for these kinds of things. If you hear a lot of people saying, particularly military, that such and such can't be true, then have a look and see, do they actually know what's going on or not, or is this just an avalanche of denials? This sort of thing does happen. Another example of that is when an aircraft was sighted in the Maldives, and there were reports in the Maldives, which is just south of India, in between India and Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, that an airliner had been sighted on the Sunday after it disappeared, half past six in the morning, by half a dozen people. Woke some people up. They looked out the window. There's a very low flying airliner, apparently flying as low as 3,000 feet, you know, which is actually for a jumbo jet very low, below the radar. You know, that would explain why it couldn't be found if it was flying so low. And then again, an avalanche of denials. So this sort of thing tells me that there is news management going on, and we've got, what people don't realise is we've got these massive strategic communications firms now. People like Bell Pottinger are sort of, you know, some, actually smaller. They manage news, and because we're so fragile in the way we get our news from, you know, a few news wires, a few big news agencies, many of the big news corporations are being merged, newspapers been taken over by, you know, a handful now of global media corporations, particularly in the Western US and in Europe, that there is not enough diversity of news. And, you know, I mean, that's what we try and do here in Bristol as a freelancer. What I do on the radio is, what we try and do is a Bristol perspective on world news, because almost all of the news comes through London. National news and international news all comes through London and through the London media here in Britain. And it's the same in most countries. You know, the capital is where that is all decided. And what we're doing is, we're doing a sort of news from a Bristol perspective on the radio, which is, you know, actually breaking the mold a little bit. Now, The Guardian started up in Manchester, and you know, it did. It was the Manchester version of the national and international news. Then it moved to London eventually, but you know, that's the model really that we're looking at. It's a way of covering these stories from a more of a provincial perspective, without the groupthink that goes with the mainstream news.
Many people would say, listening to you, would say, you know, in response to your comment that most of the news is managed by a handful of incredibly powerful corporations, and people would negate that by saying, yes, but we've got the internet now. We've got access to whatever we want on the internet. You know, these people can't control what we're seeing and the opinions that we make from the news, because we can do our own research. So how would you answer those people?
Well, I would say, for a start, yes, a lot of young people do not watch the TV, don't read normal newspapers. They have their own you know, favourite places to get their news from. But also, even the internet now is becoming, you know, populated, filtered. For example, almost everything is going through Google and Google News. I've found over the last few years, even, you know, basic searches on news sites like the Independent news site don't seem to work properly. I've had my search on my own websites attacked and hacked and destroyed, which, of course, you know, you start to look at, well, you know, there are all sorts of things that are feeding you towards Google. And I think this is the big problem on the internet, is that you've got these companies like Microsoft, Google, Facebook, Twitter. Number one, they are getting far too close to the spooks, the NSA and the GCHQ that Edward Snowden has been warning us about, because they have to decide which side they're on, and they realise where their bread is buttered. We aren't paying for most of their services, so they say, well, you know, actually, we are on the side of the spooks. They don't fight the law cases against the spooks, and they are getting far too close to them. The other side is, and it's one of the aspects, one of the things I look at quite closely, is these Bilderberg conferences, which take place every year, which are basically the NATO zone elite, you know, from the NATO countries. They all get together, the bankers, royalty, big media barons, oil companies, you know, massive amount of the financial sector all get together, and they are at these conferences. Twitter go to these conferences, Google goes to these conferences, Facebook goes to the conference.
They have been welcomed into the arms of the ruling elite, essentially, haven't they? Because of the power that they have.
Yeah, LinkedIn goes to the Bilderbergers are incredibly super rich, and they're not stupid. They realise that the media is what they are now using, as we described earlier on, in order to basically brainwash people and put a spin on every kind of world event, you know, so that they can blame who they want to for whatever is going on. Usually it's, you know, in Britain, for example, a lot of the financial trouble, a lot of the problems have been blamed on poor people, lazy people, disabled people. You know, this is what the right-wing media have done over here. And they, the Bilderberg, the people that own our world, basically, the Western world anyway, and control most of our political parties. They, you know, they fund the political parties. They fund and own much of the media. And there you go. You know, democracy is being squashed by these people. But they are absolutely key. The media is absolutely key in controlling the way we think and our consciousness. And I think there's been a real dumbing down over the last probably 20 or 30 years. Slowly but surely, the quality and the content that we've been getting through our, you know, mainstream media, the London media, has been going down and down. I mean, I would say, though, that, you know, you still can get some very, very good coverage through newspapers like, you know, The Independent, The Guardian, you know, sometimes The Daily Mirror actually does some really good content. And, of course, little, independent radio stations like yours and mine are also able to discuss this and really to get out to to a wider population, this alternative view, which has been so sadly lacking in the mainstream press. I mean, one of the things I'll tell you, for example, is I know that the likes of Google hate what I write. For example, I was writing something the other week for the RT website about the Google lawsuits and the way that Google has basically completely failed to look after the interests of privacy of all their users, and they've thrown their lot in with the spooks. Well, I sent that email off to my boss at RT. The article didn't appear, and what did I do? I texted her, actually, on the Monday after I'd sent it the previous week, said, what's happened to my article? Didn't you like it? She said, what article? Well, I'd sent it to her Gmail account, and somebody somewhere had just deleted it off her account. And this is the kind of world we're living in now. It's a kind of cyber war. If anyone is interested in reading up on this, there's some great fiction right back from the 1980s, actually. William Gibson was writing about this all that time ago, saying that actually the war is not so much like the Second World War, a war on the ground of tanks and this kind of thing, but it's a war for our minds, and it's a war of banks and big corporations fighting behind the scenes to persuade us to be on their side. And I think that's where we are now. We're a long, long way from the democracy that we think and we would like to live in.
And Tony, just before I let you go, tell me why you think those powers of which you're speaking are so successful. In other words, why are we, as people living within a civilization, able to be conned in that respect?
I think it's because, you know, the system we're living in, where the values, spiritual values, I mean, we're talking on Good Friday, those spiritual values that we've held for many, many years, are slowly being eroded by the necessity to make our decisions based on money and finance. You know, what's been happening over the last 40, 50 years is a slow smashing, I think, of the spiritual. You know, the idea of having a holiday, even today. I was hearing on the radio here this morning that, you know, is some sort of triumphal, isn't it marvellous that that horse racing is now for the first time ever taking place on Good Friday? Well, no, it's not marvellous. No. And actually, the idea is to set these important times aside. I mean, you know, it's Passover for Jewish people, Easter, and for Christians, it's, you know, it's Jesus on the cross. So that's an important time to set aside. Now, there's an erosion of that, smashing into the spiritual slowly but surely. And you have to ask yourself, I mean, Cameron's been talking God, hasn't he, in the run-up to Easter. He invited all the
it's come over all evangelical, hasn't
it? Yes, all these spiritual leaders into 10 Downing Street for his Easter Easter address. And, you know, he goes on about God, but you have to wonder, which God is he talking about, you know, here? Because it certainly seems it's mammon he's worshipping. I mean, he's been actually taking money away from really poor people, disabled people, mentally ill people that need it, and giving it to the rich, to millionaires. So, I mean, it seems to me, ultimately, what we're talking about is a rivalry between the old gods, you know, the Babylonian gods, the Greek gods, the Roman gods, and the biblical tradition, which is a Judeo-Christian tradition, even the Muslim tradition, of course, as well, who, you know, do take the Bible very seriously. And our politicians seem to be either sponsored from behind the scenes by one or other faction. Now, you know, mammon is winning. The money in a capitalist system is what buys votes, it what buys influence and opinion. And that's the message, I think. It almost sounds like a sermon, I'm sorry, but, you know, for today, for Good Friday, is that the old gods, really, you know, you have to be very, very aware that they are behind many of our modern politics.
Interesting, actually, because I'm talking to you from Spain. Of course, Semana Santa, which is Easter Holy Week, is the most holy of all the weeks, much more than Christmas here for the Spanish Catholics. And you're talking there about politicians. Of course, we saw Tony Blair himself convert to Catholicism in what was seen by many to be somewhat spurious.
Well, it's posturing. And actually, the church needs to do a better job in saying no to these people. I'm sorry, but, you know, your values are not our values.
Correct.
And unless we do that, I'm afraid what's happening is that the church itself and the biblical traditions and those traditions that we hold dear are tainted. I mean, they were tainted. I mean, I'm talking to you in Spain. I mean, in the Spanish Civil War, they were tainted by a lot of Catholics who went along with the nationalist side in a very vicious way, actually trying to, you know, control the workers, to keep the workers down, to make sure they were given good conditions, good, you know, fair pay, and they saw them as another class. Now, Jesus didn't think like that. He saw everybody as equal, and, you know, so we've got to be very careful. One of the things that worries me about Cameron is this is indicative of a real desperation. He's grasping at straws when he's trying to paint himself as a great Christian or whatever. And that's the route that Franco went down. And look where that got Spain. So, yeah. You know, that's the danger, is that we're getting to the point where some of the politicians have got absolutely no credibility, so they're really grasping. And at that point, the church leaders, and I'm sure Desmond Tutu, for example, would be kicking up a fuss, is saying, no, sorry, if you're beating the poor, if you're beating down the poor, you're starving disabled people, unemployed, that's not Jesus' message at all.
Yeah, wonderful, Tony. Really wonderful to hear you speak like this, especially since it is Easter Sunday and it is Holy Week. Tony Gosling will be joining us on Viewpoint on Tuesday. Was supposed to be with us last Tuesday, but couldn't make it due to family commitments. But this Tuesday, he will be having his say on the panel. So if anybody would like to.
Okay, Pippa, thanks very much.
Tony, thanks a lot. Take care.
Pippa Jones on TRE.
TRE.